Today is Wednesday, February 18th, 2015. Let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. Senators present, Senator Machicki, Senator Coghill, Senator Wielichowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Stoltz will be joining us shortly. Excused absences for Vice Chair Costello and Senator Stedman. Thank you to Ann, who is recording our minutes today. Thatcher is taking care of the audio, and Ike is the committee aide. So today on our agenda, we'll be hearing what has become an annual update, practically, on the Endangered Species Act. And welcome, Senator Stoltz, for joining us. So we'll be talking about listings and actions by the federal government today. Department of Fish and Game, of course, is a pivotal player in defending our state's rights, along with the Department of Law. So we welcome Commissioner-designee Sam Cotton, as well as Mr. David Rogers, the coordinator of the Endangered Species Act for the Department of Fish and Game. So welcome, gentlemen. I see also online we have Brad Mayan, Senior Assistant AG, Department of Law, and Moira Engel, Wildlife Biologist for the ESA program at ADF&G. So I will turn it over to you, Commissioner Cotton, and Coordinator Rogers. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Sam Cotton, Commissioner of Fish and Game. And we're going to do a short presentation. Mr. Rogers will walk through a PowerPoint presentation. We've got, as you mentioned, Brad Mayan from the Department of Law, who we work closely with as part of our team, as well as Moira Engels, who is one of the senior members of the what we're calling the ESA team at Department of Fish and Game. And these are important issues to us. We have specialists in marine mammals and scientists that pay close attention to these issues. So it's important to us. It's important to a lot of other people in Alaska, a lot of industries. The fishing industry pays close attention. They've had experience of being restricted as a result of listings. The oil and gas industry obviously has interest in these listings as it may affect their, and probably other industries as well, but those are the ones that we hear about the most. If I could just introduce the rest of the team here. David Rogers is a special assistant to the commissioner, and he specializes in a variety of things, ESA and federal issues, and what some people refer to as the alphabet soup agencies, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and I know you don't like acronyms, but the Endangered Species Act is what we'll talk about today. In addition to the people that are online, Bruce Dale, the director of Wildlife Conservation, is an important part of our team. He's otherwise occupied. I think he's at the Denny's restaurant in Fairbanks today, and some of you will know what that means. And Maria Gladyszewski is the acting deputy director. Kim Titus is our chief wildlife scientist and a noted polar bear expert. Kelly Nesfacil is another ESA biologist with our program. In addition, Bob Small is a wildlife scientist specializing in marine mammals. Dave Tesler, statewide coordinator with the program, and Dan Rosenberg with the waterfowl program. So I'm just going to ask David to walk through, unless you had other questions at the moment here, his presentation. We hope to be able to answer your questions, but that's one of the reasons that that Brad's here, to help with probably some discussion on some of the litigation that might be current, and he may be limited in his ability to get into too much detail on that, but he'd be the resource for that. And Moira, again, our senior biologist, who's been doing this for about 3 years. She's also got a law degree. She spent some time in the Habitat Division and has bachelor's and master's degrees in wildlife biology, so extremely experienced and competent staff here. So I would just ask Mr. Rogers to please proceed.
That'd be great. And if senators could interrupt you during your presentation with questions, that's okay?
Okay.
All right, great. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. For those of you who don't know me very well or don't remember me, a little bit about my background, 2 seconds. I'm a lawyer and practiced actively for 15 or 20 years. Don't practice actively anymore. Focuses on business law primarily, but when you're a sole proprietor, you take other things as they come in the door. I've also done some lobbying in the context of being a lawyer for represented both industry and the conservation community. I worked for I don't know how many legislative committees, pretty much in the early stage of my career, maybe seven, a couple times with the Senate Finance Committee, the Senate Advisory Council, which is an old think tank that didn't survive. I was the charter senior advisor on natural resources. I worked for the House Resources Committee. I worked for the Speaker of the House, Mr. Cotton, at one point, so we have connections there. I've also, this is my fourth tour of duty in the government. I worked for the Department of Natural Resources in the early 80s for Commissioners Laresch and Katz. Then I was the special counsel to the Alaska Railroad Transfer Team under DOT in the early 80s, and we set up the Alaska Railroad Corporation. Later on, I went to work for DEC, first as a program manager and then as the deputy director of the Air and Water Quality Division, which is no more. And now I'm working for the Department of Fish and Game, so this is my fourth, probably my last hurrah in government. I also am a business owner, a family. We own a family business. We've owned and operated several over the years. We currently operate a beverage distribution company that operates throughout Southeast Alaska. So that's me in a nutshell. Let's get started. We'll skip this. Now, I have some sort of 101, a few slides of 101. Is that okay? Or we all, okay?
That's great.
So let's just start with a suite of relevant laws. Endangered Species Act, of course, of 1973, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Administrative Procedure Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Alaska Endangered Species Act, in case you didn't know that there was one. There is an Alaska Endangered, and there are a few species listed under that act. It's different standards between the federal and state system, and I don't think it's been operating. I don't think there's been a listing in a while. I think there was a potential listing back in 2009. I'm still trying to get the history straight on that. So, ESA listing and critical habitat processes. So, the applicable agency has to use the best scientific and commercial data available, and no new research is required, determine whether a species is an endangered species or a threatened species because of any of the following five factors. We'll go through them quickly. Present or threatened destruction, modification, or curtailment of its habitat or range, overutilization for a variety of purposes, disease or predation, the inadequacy of existing regulatory mechanisms, and other natural or man-made factors affecting its continued existence. Now, endangered, in case you're wondering the difference between endangered and threatened, endangered species is in danger of extinction throughout all or a significant portion of its range. Threatened species is likely to become an endangered species within the foreseeable future.
So, question, Mr. Rogers. So, under endangered, there's no time frame. That is to say, in danger of extinction in the next 50 years.
Well, we will discuss.
You're going to that.
Yeah, I'm going to focus on that very issue.
Perfect. Right, and you'll probably talk about the definition of foreseeable future.
Well, I won't. If Brad Meyer and me, I'm not okay. Sure I will. But as we get there, I think this will. Because we want to focus on the climate change aspect of listings right now, because that's sort of the issue of the moment to discuss. So we'll get there.
All right.
With your indulgence. Just quickly, listing isn't limited to just a species. It can include subspecies and what they call distinct population segments, DPS, a little acronym. An example would be stellar sea lions. The eastern DPS was initially listed as threatened, and now it's delisted. It was delisted in 2012. On the other hand, the western distinct population segment is still listed as endangered, so they made some choices there. What happens? Okay, what's the practical effect of being listed? A major one is what they call Section 7. So if the project has a nexus, a federal nexus, a permit or a federal funding that may affect a listed species, then they undertake what's called a Section 7 consultation process. There are multiple steps in that process. It also, under Section 9, it prohibits the take of a listed species. And It's a broad term. It's illegal to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or attempt to engage in any such conduct. Now, there are exceptions. Alaska Native subsistence harvest for marine mammals is an exception. And for threatened species, the service can specify other exceptions under a 4D of the rule. Okay, we don't need to go through the list, but here's the list of federally endangered species under the federal rules. Note stellar sea lions, bowhead whales, Cook Inlet belugas, humpbacks, etc. I'll let you look at that list for a second while I take a drink. Thank you. Few examples. Threatened. The Fish and Wildlife Service has a number of threatened species on the list, including the polar bear and the northern sea otter and the wood bison. We'll talk about that project, and then I know you have an interest in that. Mm-hmm. So, and National Marine Fisheries Service ring seals are listed as threatened, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. So, let's talk with pending reintroductions. Wood bison is the one I think people have heard about. I think there was a story last night on one of the news channels about the introduction of wood bison. It's before our time, my predecessors worked hard to get rules that would give management authority to the state. It's a special category under threat, and they are generally listed as threatened, I think, worldwide, as I understand it. But this is a special category. It's for non-essential experimental populations, and the normal hoops don't apply. And the management plan is almost complete, and the reintroduction to Innoko, Lower Yukon, is coming soon. I think they're starting to ship them. And there's also a Steller's Eider reintroduction that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working to reintroduce them in Yukon Kuskokwim Delta. So under consideration for listing, the Pacific walrus, the Alexander Archipelago wolf, sometimes called Southeast wolves, the Alaska yellow cedar, which is a tree, not a critter, and seals in Iliamna Lake. Delisted, and there's only one new one. I think you've heard this before, but the Arctic peregrine falcon, the Aleutian Canada goose, the Eastern DPS stellar sea lion, which was delisted in 2012, and there's one on the list, in the works, the humpback whale, the Central North Pacific stock humpback whale. We petitioned for delisting. We're expecting a decision soon, perhaps April. We'll see. I'll keep you all in the loop on that one. I'm sure you'd be interested.
Yeah.
Not warranted. So, and state research, again, before my time, but state research has contributed to a lot of these. You can see the list. Note the Pinto abalone and Southeast Alaska herring and the ribbon seal and 43 species of Alaska corals. Okay, let's focus on an issue, a current issue, climate change. And there are three listings based on climate change arguments. The polar bear, based on a projected loss of sea ice within 50 years. And the bearded seal, which we'll talk about in more detail a little later, loss of sea ice within 100 years. And the ring seal, similar arguments for the ring seal to the bearded seal, 100-year projections. Now, there are also three petitions that I'm aware of based on climate change, the Alaska yellow cedar, seals in Iliamna Lake and the Pacific walrus. So, climate change listing concerns. The one is the precautionary listing of ice-dependent species like the polar bear and the ice seals. In a lot of these cases, there's limited evidence of current declines, and the models are predicting way out. Possible extinction from 45 to 100 years in the future. And I guess the question there, footnote, is that really the appropriate time frame? I think, I believe there's, the climate's changing whatever the cause, and the question is how do you address that? Now, we'll also talk in the next slide about recovery and habitat issues.
Excuse me, Mr. Rogers. Senator Machiki had a question.
Yes, sir.
So I, you know, someone can take off with this very question and make some assumptions about what I'm going to ask, but here's what I'm going to ask. I would say that, you know, I don't want to give a number, but thousands of species have become extinct in the last hundreds of years. I don't, again, it's hard to quantify what exactly has happened. Some of it's, you know, atmospheric, oceanic, ambient temperature things, predation, disease. What kind of credit is given to natural forces that have little to do with human interaction if a species becomes extinct? Is there any credit given for that, I mean, going forward? Is it even something that's studied when a species becomes close to extinction?
That's a good question that I can't answer, but I'd like to shift that one to one of my lifelines. Brad Mayen, are you on board?
Mr. Mayen, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Did you hear the question, Brad?
Yes, I did. The question was in connection with, for example, natural causes that may cause an animal to go extinct. And the five factors that were mentioned earlier that are looked at for listing a species does not make a distinction of whether it is a human-caused event or some natural event. So, in other words, a species can still be listed if it is just a naturally occurring event.
Mr. Mayen, for our record and those listening, would you please begin by identifying yourself for the record and your affiliation, please?
Yes, excuse me, Madam Chair. This is Brad Mayen, Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Alaska Department of Law, and my section is the Natural Resources section, and I work almost exclusively on endangered species work.
Great. Thank you very much. Follow-up question, Senator Machiki.
Follow-up through the chair. So what you're saying is whether or not human interaction is related to the potential extinction of a species, the same impacts and limitations on human behavior is put into place. Is that correct?
Is that a question for Mr. Mayen?
It is.
Oh, yes. So, Mr. Mayen? And if you would identify yourself when you begin to speak, also again for our recorder.
Through the chair, this is Brad Mayen speaking again. As to the factors, whether human or naturally caused factors, and I'm not sure I've got the exact question, but when the agency, whether it's the National Marine Fisheries Service or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is considering the listing of a species, it will evaluate those conditions, and it will note whether they are human caused or whether these are natural factors. And for example, you know, natural factors could be sustained periods of drought, something along that line that is causing an impact to the habitat. So while they'll relate those to their consideration, as far as for weighing the factors are giving what due weight before they list the species, they would still go ahead and list the species if they find that species is either one, currently, you know, imminently endangered, which would be an endangered listing, or that would likely become an endangered species in the foreseeable future. And that gets back to the time period, for example, on climate change, whether they're going to look out 50 years or 100.
Follow-up, Senator Machiki.
Yes, Mr. Mayen. So the second part of that question is whether or not the human activity is related to the listing. There likely will be limitations on human activity, whether or not it's related to the endangerment of that species. Is that correct?
There are put protections, and again, this is Brad Mayen speaking again. The agency, if it determines to list the species, and then it determines to provide certain, you know, limitations under the Endangered Species Act, there could be limitations on utilization or for certain activities, even if it hasn't anything to do with, you know, the cause. For example, if there was being impacts from a drought and the human activity had to deal with running a railroad through an area, there could be limitations on the construction of the railroad or special provisions put into the provisions for approving a railroad, even though that doesn't have anything to do with the actual cause, for example, drought. So I don't know if that's getting at the question, but the limitations could be without reference to the actual cause of the decline.
That answers my question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, the one good example of that is the Stellar Sea Lion, the Western DPS, where the agency really couldn't determine what the cause was, but it was very, very clearly the fix was to restrict fishing. The presumption was nutritional stress for the Stellar Sea Lion, but that was never really, they were never able to prove that, but they were able to restrict human activity.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Welikowski.
Thank you. And question for either Commissioner or Mr. Mayen. Can someone explain to me the basic process of how a species gets listed? Who can petition, and then what sort of process you go through to get it listed, and what sort of ability the state has or other individuals have to challenge that?
Madam Chair, I would defer to either David or Mr. Mayen.
I think Mr. Mayen would be the best person to answer your questions.
All right. Mr. Mayen, you've been called on to answer that question.
Well, through the Chair, this is Brad Mayen again, and the process to list the species can either be on the own initiative of the National Marine Service, Fisheries Service, or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The federal agencies themselves can initiate the process, or it can begin with a petition, and the petition can be filed by anyone, by an environmental organization, a trade organization, which has happened for delisting petitions. But it starts a process. Now, it's not just a petition, like a couple of pages that says we'd like to see such and such species listed. It must be a document that reviews the science, states the reasons for the need to list, and then that is submitted to the agency. At that time, the agency has a 90-day period to review the petition and make a determination on whether further review is warranted. But just real quickly, during that 90-day period of time, they basically just pull open their files and see what information they have on hand to determine and evaluate that process and see whether further investigation is warranted. You know, for example, that has happened with the seals, the freshwater seals that are found in Lake Iliamna, and the National Marine Fisheries Service found that there was enough information to warrant further review of that seal and the impacts of climate change on that seal. And on a positive 90-day finding, then there's another review period. There's a 12-month review period, which is then initiated. During that 12-month review period, then the public, including the state, is allowed to provide and submit comments to the federal agency on what the agency should be looking at in the status of that species. At the end of that 12-month period, the federal agency must make a finding of whether there is a sufficient information to warrant listing the species and then publish a proposed rule, make a finding that listing is not warranted at this time, or make a finding that listing is warranted, but there are other species that need more attention at this time and the agency doesn't have time to get to it. And for that reason, the species is then put on a candidate species list and looked at a further time period. If the decision is to go ahead and propose listing the species, then we have another 12-month period of time. Again, the public and the state is given an opportunity to submit comments. Now, at this time, you know, litigation can't be filed in an attempt to stop the efforts because it is yet to be a final agency rule. The rule must become final under the formal rulemaking process of the Administrative Procedure Act of the United States. At such time that the rule is final, though, after taking into context and reviewing all the information that's been provided on the species, any hearings that have been held on the species, and then the final determination of the agency, at that time, if the decision is to list the species, then at that time, it opens up a six-year window of time where litigation to review that administrative decision can be filed.
Follow-up, Senator Welikowski?
Yeah, thank you.
Kind of just a thumbnail sketch of it, but there are two occasions of public information solicitation, and that's the first 12-month period and the second 12-month period.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Just one follow-up. What's the standard of review for courts that are looking at this? Is it an abuse of discretion standard, or is it a higher standard?
It's Brad Mayen to the Chair. It's the abuse of discretion standard. The fact that the administrative record must support the decision, and the agency must be able to connect the dots through the information that they reviewed and the decision they reached.
follow-up?
And then just one last question.
Yes.
What's the court's view of challenges to ESA listings? Are they often overturned or are often not overturned? What's your experience?
Again, Brad Mayen through the chair. If it's a challenge of an actual listing, the listing of a species, it's an uphill battle because the agencies they get deference in two ways. They get courted deference from the courts if there's some sort of an interpretation of the ESA that they have been filled in through promulgation of regulations. And then a second area where they're given deference is an evaluation of the science. But having said that, and what has been happening in two recent cases dealing with climate change, it doesn't mean that in a challenge, if there is no record or if the decision is contrary to the record, that a party that is challenging cannot prevail. And for example, these items will be discussed in a minute, but the state's been a party to two cases now where at least at the district court level, the judge has vacated the decision and sent it back to the agency for further consideration.
Thank you. So, yes, Senator Coghill.
This is just part of that fundamental question, and Brad, am I saying the right name? Yeah, Brad. So the slide we're on talks about precautionary listings, and it also talks about models, and those models are speculative in many, many ways because they're trying to look out 100 years or they're trying to look out 20 years, and even the models that we look back on show that we haven't predicted very well. So how do they, when it goes to court or when they have to describe that on an application for a listing, does the court get to review that, or is that something that is considered science now?
Brad Mayen, again, through the chair. The court gets to review the information that the agency has relied upon. Now, that has been the exact point, and I don't want to jump ahead on the slide, but we were going to get to a slide that talks about court's review of exactly that, the models, and the fact that in one instance, the bearded seal case, where the federal agency made a real cursory review, they did as you suggested. They made an assumption of the models and that sea ice would no longer be there to support the life strategies of the bearded seal in 100 years, and on that basis alone, found that the species should be listed as a threatened species. However, there was no connection of the dots. There was not an analysis of, say, for example, in a progression starting from now through this 100 years, what are the types, how the impact of the life strategy of the species, how exactly is that species going to be impacted? Are their numbers going to be decreased as such? So yes, they will consider that. They'll consider how the agency addressed those issues.
Thank you. I jumped ahead of them. I'll be more patient.
Well, let me jump back because clarify for me. I'm looking at slide number 3. It says ESA Section 4, Listing and Critical Habitat Processes. It says using the, quote, best scientific and commercial data available. And then in parentheses, it says no new research not required. So really? They don't have to do anything new in terms of science research? I guess I'm asking Mr. Rogers.
Well, we keep asking Mr. Mayen.
Okay, we'll keep asking Mr. Mayen. Wow, you're really getting the questions. So, Mr. Mayen, really? No, new research is not required?
Yes, Brad Mayen to the church. No, that's correct. They do not have to do new research. But having said that, it's been, and again, we'll be discussing these further, and Mr. Rogers did mention some areas in talking about the yellow-billed loon, the Kitsilks mullet, and other species where the Department of Fish and Game has been anticipating what species may be of interest for potential listings and proactively putting science, in the works so that at the time that it is actually looked at, there is fresh, more and better science that is available for the agency to look at. So, that is a concern. So it's a matter of how do you keep up with the science versus the timing when the listing is done, because otherwise, you're correct, there could be a really stale and the decision is made on really inadequate information.
Thank you for that. So that raises another question in my mind then. You've said that ADFMG has been doing some anticipatory work. We're seeing some budget cuts. You're in the Department of Law. I'm hearing that there's been some movement as far as people that know this subject matter. How do you foresee that affecting the state's effectiveness in pushing back on these designations? Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I'm not prepared to address them. You know, the budget constraints are proposed. I do just know with my position here that I personally have been working on these topics and issues the past 7 years, and based upon what litigation I have right now and what I anticipate in the near future, I think that between our capabilities that we have here and the relationship that we have with Fish and Game, that, you know, at least here in the near future, we're able to handle that. That doesn't mean we won't make some decisions based upon certain priorities, but for what we have in front of us right now.
Thank you. So it leads to a question for Mr. Rogers and Commissioner Cotton. Will ADFMG continue to have the robust staff focus on developing this proactive science?
I'll let the commissioner handle that one.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's really hard to say at the moment because we don't know what the final budget is going to look like, but so far it appears that we will be able to continue our work without too much problem. Now, that's there's some uncertainty as to the remainder of the budget process, of course.
And we're serious about this, Madam Chair. Yeah, and we will do what within our powers, we will do what we have to do to continue a robust effort on these issues.
Okay, great. Question, Senator Machicki.
I do have one, and this is likely for Mr. Mayan as well. It seems to me that when other federal agencies decisions help in a listing, and I'll give an example. The Cook Inlet beluga whale, I remember a fairly significant subsistence fishery not too long before. It was a pretty substantial harvest attempt, right? And I sat on the NIMS, National Marine Fisheries Evaluation Group. Of course, we were fighting the listing, but the first page of the summary said that we were unable to consider the subsistence fishery as an effect in the decision of the listing. Does the state, in certain cases like the beluga whale listing in Cook Inlet, I mean, do they have a legal leg to stand on that says, hey, you're limiting future activities, human-related activities in the critical habitat area, yet clearly... And I'm not going to try to quantify the effect from the subsistence harvest, but clearly there was an effect, an adverse effect that led toward the listing. Do we have anything to stand on in those situations? And I'm not sure which of you want to answer, but it surely seemed like they just decided they weren't going to consider their own mistakes in some of the causal factors of the decline.
I'll let Mr. Mayan's doing a great job, so let's let him continue. He's got the 8 years of experience.
Mr. Mayan?
Well, I'm Brad Mayan, and through Madam Chair. On this specific one, it's the twist that Alaska has that other states don't necessarily have is the fact that we have marine mammals, which are also governed under a special act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the same marine mammals that have been listed or been petitioned to be listed under the Species Act. So it has a double layers of protection and double layers of, and even slight differences in what's considered a take. In this instance, this is going back at two stages. For example, as you mentioned, the Cook Inlet beluga whale, it was known back in 1999, 2000, when the first attempts were made to list the species of the impacts of the subsistence harvest. At that time, it was, of course, taken into account, and attempts were made to list under the State Act and the Federal Act, and both were denied at that time. Later, in 2008, after giving a period of 8 years, the federal agency went back again. NIMS looked at the situation and saw that nothing had changed or no improvement in the population level, and then decided to list the species. So I'm just basically, I think that's probably a recitation of the facts and where we got to the listing. And in that instance, you know, the state of Alaska did challenge the listing of blue-gill whale at that time. We did, as part of that, indicate that the known impacts of the reasons why it had occurred, I mean, and recited that to the court, but again, it, the court then looked at, well, regardless of how we got there, this is where we're at now with the population level and the deference given to the agency, and the decision was upheld. But so I don't know if I answered the question, but it is a more difficult situation when you combine marine mammals and you combine the subsistence type issues. But even under the Endangered Species Act, as was mentioned earlier, even for a listed species, subsistence is still allowed to take place.
Any further follow-up, Senator Machiki?
Just one, and this is more sort of philosophical. Are we going to, do we have the potential for similar conditions in the future? I mean, is one hand talking to the other, or are they, is there any potential for adjusting subsistence harvests prior to species becoming threatened or endangered?
You're on, Brad.
Okay, well, Brad, it's hard to make a guess when I don't see, I'm not aware of the situation now where there are any of those sorts of, you know, those sorts of risks. Other than it would probably be hopeful the agencies will review the prior situations and, you know, address the matter, you know, accordingly. I think that's best I can do on that one. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
All right.
And my apologies for jumping in, Madam Chair.
No worries.
I just thought I'd need, you know, to keep the flow going. But
Of course.
All right.
I'm not seeing any further questions. I think we were at the wood bison.
We're now talking about listing concerns.
Okay.
And a couple that are on the list now. How do you develop recovery objectives for species at currently healthy levels but projected to decline? How do you address that? And how should critical habitat be designated if species range is projected to change? Now, another point is that ESA provides, you know, few additional protections from the existing Marine Mammal Protection Act protections. So the ultimate question, I think, that we all have to ponder is whether listings based on climate change warrant a different approach, a different way of thinking about it. Okay, let's talk about critical habitat, another current issue, expansive designations. We've got 187,000 square miles. For the polar bear, that was vacated.
Right. Yes.
Excuse.
No. Had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the previous slide on climate change,
yes,
what is the department's position on climate change? How do you view it scientifically, politically? And
that's a commissioner level question.
It's not a theological question, Madam Chair. It's a scientific question.
I was going to try to clarify that, Madam Chair. Yes. So I want to make sure I understand the question.
So, Commissioner, and as you answer the question, if you would identify yourself. So, folks listening, that's the Commissioner, not Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
Ma'am. Thank you. All right.
So, if you don't mind, can I get a clarification on the question?
Absolutely. Yes.
What part needs to be clarified?
What do you want to know what the department's position is, Madam Chair? The Senator wants to know what the department's position is on climate change.
On climate change, if you're defending it, do you have a position? I guess, Madam Chair, is the first question. Is it necessary for you to have a position in approaching this?
Madam Chair,
and secondly, does the administration have a position?
I'm not prepared to describe the administration's position on climate change at this time. I think we're aware that there's a lot of changes in the climate in the Arctic, and we are more specifically focusing in on some of the listings like this that are using climate change as a nexus, and we're in the process in some cases of challenging those decisions based on the 100-year, for example, horizon. But we're not prepared to talk about, general climate change policy today.
And just, go ahead, Senator.
I'm not trying to play stump the commissioner, and I know we've had a long history, but it is a relevant issue as we're dealing with. That's a big part of this whole ESA issue. It's all interwoven into that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah, just to add, Senator, regardless of the cause, I think there's something going on, and it's something we have to take into account as we think about how to address some of these issues. But the cause is not something any of us has discussed as a policy matter since I showed up 8 weeks ago.
Madam Chair.
All right, Senator.
Maybe we can try Mr. Mayan as a legal position or strategy in addressing this through litigation. If that might be the better approach, if we might.
Would you like to ask Mr.
Yes.
Mayan?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Mr. Mayan, have you been listening? And do you have a?
Yes, this is Mr. Mayan, and to the chair. Yes, I've been listening.
Do you have a response?
I don't have responses to addressing any policy. As far as for the climate change issues here and the modeling of climate change, what we address in the litigation is the substantiation of the projections that are made when they talk about 100 years and those potential impacts on the species. So it's really a record-based review.
Very good. Follow-up, Senator Stoltz?
I think we'll stop there.
Okay. Great.
Okay. So I think we're back at critical habitat issues. You know, the expansive designations, the 187,000 square miles for polar bears, which was vacated, and the proposed ring seal critical habitat of 350,000 square miles. By the way, those rules are we're in the comment period, and comments are due on March 31st. We're in the process of developing our comments. That'll be the first time you'll get to see what this new administration is saying about these matters. So I'll keep you in the loop, Madam Chair.
Okay, that'd be great. Any preview on
we haven't sat down to discuss the details. We're getting there. In fact, I hope to sit down in the next week or two with Moira, who's doing the heavy lifting on the draft, and we'll take it from there. But we will keep you advised.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
And it's just a committee process. When people refer to by first names, I don't know who
My apologies. Madam Chair, yes. Moira Engel, who's online, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so where were we? So now the definition of, the sort of the boundaries for the discussion of critical habitat are ESA Section 3, which says that critical habitat means the specific areas within the occupied area where biological and physical features essential to the conservation of the species are found. Now, Section 5 also adds that critical habitat should now include the entire geographical area which can be occupied by the species. One thing that's new, there has to be an economic analysis associated with critical habitat designations and terminations. I think it's a brand new requirement, or a relatively new requirement. And the Secretary, as I understand it, has discretion to exclude areas based on the economic analysis. So that's another factor that may be useful.
So, Mr. Rogers, stopping there. So it says critical habitat shall not include the entire geographical area. So as we look then at the ring seal, it appears that it is including the entire geographical area. And on the humpback whale, that was based on distinct population segments, or that petition was filed, right? So is that an opportunity here to limit the area that would be considered critical habitat?
Well, it's an opportunity to comment, and like I said, we haven't developed the comments. I suspect that will be a concern of ours.
Okay.
And yes, I mean, but we don't ultimately control the final decision, but we can do our best to influence that final decision. And if we conclude that it's too much, then we're going to argue for less, a more appropriate way of looking at it.
So to follow up on that, do you have any new or current science on the populations in geographic areas of this very large possible critical habitat?
I'll have to defer that to Brad, who's been working on these cases.
Oh, okay.
Just so you understand, Madam Chair, I've been here 8 weeks.
Understood.
And there's a lot on my plate, and I'm just getting used to these issues. So
sure.
I apologize for deferring, but I want to get you good answers, not to...
And I appreciate that you have the lifelines.
Yes.
So, Mr. Mayan, can you fill us in?
This is Brad Mayan, through Madam Chair. Is the question about the population levels for the designation of critical habitat for the ring seal?
What my question was is it sounds like a petition related to distinct population segments for this very large critical habitat might be an argument. And my question was, do you have any new science or even historic science that would refute this very large critical habitat designation?
Brad Mayan, through Madam Chair, for the ring seal, it's known that the seals number in the millions, and that's about all that I can say and what's recorded in NIMS own information. And this is addressing a particular subspecies of ring seal, the Arctic ring seal, which is the one subspecies that's within U.S. and Alaska territory. That species does exist in other jurisdictions, in other countries, in international waters. So it's a very large population in numbers, and you correctly identified that as far as for the area covered in U.S. territory, these have essentially designated or proposed to designate its entirety, not the specific critical area. So that is exactly what one of the arguments would be, that it isn't a specific area, the area needed for the sustainability of the species.
Okay, thank you. Yes, did Senator Stoltz have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's an overreaching question I have, and it's to the Commissioner. It's there was a the administration change, and there was a change in the personnel in your department. We were ready, I was ready to, I think some folks were ready to go to watch an RDC presentation by Mr. Vincent Lang, and we have a copy of that presentation that was never delivered. Just in general, can you just describe what, if there have been any, what would you describe as any strategy changes, philosophical changes, as we've had personnel changes and different approach isn't necessarily bad. I'm trying to understand and get around my hands around a confidence level in the administration, and that comes through understanding better. And it's not meant to be an offensive question, but it's really one to allow you to talk about your strategy and what you aren't changing and what you are changing, and other than personnel, obviously.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, to my knowledge, the administration hasn't changed direction, hasn't changed philosophy. We're still pursuing some of the same issues that the previous administration was pursuing. We are evaluating, where there were successes and where there were lack thereof. So we want to learn from mistakes and want to build on the areas where we've had success. But at least specifically with the Endangered Species Act, and I think we've focused in on a couple of specific cases here today, there's, to my knowledge, no strategy change or direction change. We're still, for example, on the ring seals, we're still interested in the deficiencies in the proposal by the United States government.
Just a short
comment. Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. And it's really hard to separate, you know, some things we heard in the campaign, and then as you're campaigning and governing are two markedly different things. And but during the campaign, there was a lot of criticism about excessive lawsuits and unproductive lawsuits, and we need to talk to people. And those are my recollections anyway, not having TV, so through other venues. That, and I guess I'm kind of a, is, you believe there's the same commitment on litigation to aggressively pursue and pound things through the court and, I mean, and make sure we're at the same table where the NGOs and the federal agencies are at?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, at least on the ones we're focusing on today, I'd say the commitment's as strong. And the Department of Law is going to have to speak for their own efforts as far as some of the questions you have there. But again, if we've had experiences that were not successful, either litigation or otherwise, we may decide that we can't afford some of those things. Now, if they've been successful, if we've experienced success, we want to recognize that. But if we've also, if we've beat our head against the walls with no tangible results, we should recognize that as well. And I'm not pointing anything specifically in that area, but if you ask about litigation strategy, again, I'd have to defer to the Department of Law. They're the ultimate decider on whether to litigate. But I think my recommendation would be that we should learn from any failed efforts, and we should build on any successful efforts.
Madam Chair, can I just add, Senator, is that right? I'm a lawyer. I understand litigation, and it's an important tool in the toolbox. Money's tight. You know, it changes the equation a little bit. You have to be strategic. But I don't think any of us is afraid of appropriate litigation. There'll be standards when it makes sense, excuse me, when it doesn't. But it's still on the table as an option. And frankly, it is a good tool for getting everyone around that table to discuss these issues. Sometimes it's necessary because you need to win, and you need to take a shot at it. And sometimes it has other value. But talking has value, too. I have a history of negotiating complicated issues, Exxon Valdez, HB 567, and the cruise ship. I mean, I understand negotiating. I understand that. And talking has value. It has value, but it doesn't always work. And litigation doesn't always work. You sort of take your best shot. And often you start with a chat but decide if that's going to go anywhere. It's all of, and I don't really see a change in the way we're thinking about this right now. Now, when we sit down and make some final decisions, and Commissioner Cotton signs a comment, that'll be the real test of how we feel, and that will be the best way for you to judge case by case how we're looking at these things. But right now, I don't see a difference.
Did you have follow-up, Senator?
Yeah, Madam Chair. It's hard to do emissions and measures evaluation on something you prevented from happening. An NGO negotiating with a federal official, and it's really hard to evaluate the value of having been in that room. I hope there's when we talked about ESAs in the past, we had we always had the attorney generals there. And it was the previous administration. It was an elevated, starting with over three of them, starting with John Burns, and then Mr. Sullivan, and then Mr. Garrity. They were always in. It was at a heightened level. The attorney general himself were at a lot of the presentations, carrying the banner. And I don't know. I guess this week I'm just a little fired up. I listened to a speech the other morning. About aggressive action or negotiation and talking your way through things, and not saying that our adversaries are ISIS, but they're also hard to negotiate with.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Senator Walikowski.
Thank you. I would like to encourage you to take a careful look at these cases, and the cases you think you can win, obviously go forward on. But the abuse of discretion standard is probably the easiest standard for an agency to win with. I mean, is that a fair statement? In the gamut of standards that you have, from strict scrutiny to you know, the middle level constitutional test to rational basis, abuse of discretion is like way on the bottom. I mean, is that a fair statement? Maybe for you, David, or for Brad?
Brad has been doing this. I abuse of discretion is a tough argument. Brad, what's your experience, Madam Chair, if I may?
Mr. Mayan, could you respond to Senator Welikowski's question, please?
This is Brad Mayan through Madam Chair. You're correct. That is a very difficult standard, but what we've learned through our litigation is that under the ESA, the one advantage that the state has is that there's Section 4I, which requires the federal government to respond specifically to state comments on whether to list the species or not, whether to designate critical habitat or not. And today, that's been the strong arm in this litigation where they failed to do it. So yes, that they are given that deference, but because it's a record review case and we're allowed to go back and look at how they address specific comments for the state, and that's why the state has been a very important player in particularly the challenge of the designation of critical habits for the polar bear and in the challenge for the listing of the bearded seals. And in both cases, the court recognized that obligation to respond to the state and also recognized the failure of it. So there are areas, and we've evaluated them, and so we know when we can, make those types of arguments. And so there is a role to play on that basis.
Follow-up, Senator Welikowski. Senator Machicki.
Yes, through the chair, for Mr. Mayan, I don't know if the 350,000 square mile proposed listing makes the Guinness Book of Critical Habitat records or not, but it sure seems like a large swath of real estate, especially with 1 million seals in existence. So it seems like they're at least interested in violating the ESA Section 5. And my question is this, and I don't mean to suggest diabolical intent, but some of these listings almost seem to be project specific. And my question is this. What we talked about the process, what we didn't talk about is what could actually begin the process. Does the process begin with an environmental NGO, stopping a member of a federal agency and saying, hey, psst, seems to me like we have a problem with bearded or ringed seals. I haven't noticed what area it might be in, but you might take a look at this. I mean, what is it that begins the evaluation process, and can it be an environmental NGO that just simply opposes Arctic exploration?
This is Brad Mayan, and through Madam Chair, I guess I'm not putting it as such of a behind the scenes type of thing, because it's straight up front. And what's happened in these instances with all the animals that we've been talking about is an actual formal paper filed by the NGOs saying we want to see these species listed, and they just don't say that. They go through and provide a biological reason for it, where they reviewed the science and state the reasons why they want to see it listed. And again, that triggers it, and the agency says, oh, okay, we've got that, we're going to review it. I mean, it's pretty straightforward on that basis. Now, if there has been no petition, yes, you're right, it's the agency itself. The agency itself can just be sitting at their desk having informal discussions and decide, we've looked at something in this type of area, we want to give a further look for it, and then they can provide a notice that we're going to go ahead and do our own and begin our own agency review of whether or not to list the species. And that has occurred as well.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki.
So, Mr. Mayan, what you're saying is there at least exists the potential for the abuse of the Endangered Species Act on a project-specific basis.
Madam Chair, this is Brad Mayan. I guess if you consider there's a specific project within a massive area, but it's hard to address a hypothetical. I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you.
All right. Looks like no further questions at this moment, so I'll let you continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're now moving into a new territory, state strategy, and there are several segments here. The political strategy, building partnerships with various organizations. This is not new. A prior administration was involved in these organizations, and we are too. In fact, our director and others are going to the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agency gathering in, I think it's Omaha, Nebraska. We'll have a team there. And you know, we intend, to the extent that we can pay for the travel, we intend to, you know, actively participate in these things. And that would include the State Federal ESA Task Force, which is probably something I will get involved with. And there will be someone there in next week, but not me, that's coming. And then, you know, bringing concerns to Congress and others, that's, you know, that's also an option. It's something we haven't had time to really talk through, but it's something that can be effective, maybe. It's certainly an option that we need to carefully consider, and we have a pretty good Senate delegation there that will, I think, is pretty sympathetic to a lot of these issues.
So, yes, Commissioner.
Just on that score, it's been suggested to me that there have been cases that we haven't been successful with, even though we think that our reading of ANILCA, for example, was very, very straightforward and clear. But if you can't prevail there, then perhaps, I mean, the only other thing to do is to have Congress rewrite statutes. And so that's why one of the reasons we want to make sure that our delegation and many other states that participate in these associations have similar views, and we find ourselves on pretty common ground in several areas. So the theory, of course, is that you have more states that are campaigning for changes to federal law, the more likely your chances of success.
So to follow up on that last bullet point, what have you identified any specific pieces of the Endangered Species Act that you would like to see changed?
Well, I'm not sure that I would have anything in particular on ESA. I know that there's some authority issues in ANILCA that are on a kind of a different subject, but it's a similar genre of subjects there. But perhaps Mr. Mayan might have some specific issues in ESA that he's focused on.
Madam Chair, if I could just add, it's something I want to talk about within internally, because I think we haven't had that opportunity, but I think we need to take a good hard look at the Act and see if there is, and maybe Mr. Mayan will give me a few suggestions.
I plan to ask
an opportunity. Yes.
Yes. Mr. Mayan, have you in your practice identified any specific pieces of the ESA that you would like to see changed?
This is Brad Mayan through Madam Chair. There have been some areas that the previous administration has looked at. I haven't had an opportunity to speak with Commissioner Cotton about all of those at this time. One of the ones, though, that I know that is kind of generally felt throughout all the state agencies and wildlife agencies, and that is when we talk about deference and deference given to science, it's about elevating the deference and consultation with the states and, you know, on the state science. And, you know, that's the one that I feel comfortable in, you know, in sharing at this time. But, you know, there certainly are several items, you know, along that line that you know, that not just Alaska, but other states would like to see considered. And the meetings that were just mentioned, those items will be discussed at that time, you know, as well. So, and I'll be able to work further with the administration here on that.
Very good. Senator Stoltz, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking back to past years, and we're in a different regime now, but it seems like we had the Department of Law here, and then we had directors and ESA staff from the Fish and Game. And does this reflect a juxtaposition of who's taking the lead? Because in the past, it was the Department of Law, and then we had individuals such as Mr. Vincent Lang and others supplementing the Department of Law's case. And that, I don't know if that's your, I was in the other body, and that was the way we represented these issues. It was law took the lead. And has there been a shifting of the lead agents, lead departments?
Yes, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator, well, as I mentioned earlier, the actual decision as to whether to litigate is with the Department of Law. I don't think that's a question. The Department of Fish and Game has in the past taken some leadership role in working with other states and on specific issues. Most recently, the National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, preserve lands in Alaska and some of our hunting regulations. So that's been an area that that Fish and Game would be likely to take the lead on. The ESA issues, we kind of view our role now as a resource for the Department of Law. We evaluate things like this ring seal designation, for example, and have opined how we see it. And so, again, I'm not sure that it's always going to be one department taking the lead, but certainly at the end of the day, the Department of Law, and the chairman invited us here today, so we asked the Department of Law person we work with to join us to help us out, and obviously we needed it. So perhaps you may decide you want the Department of Law here at another occasion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Stoltz. Excuse me, Coghill. Pardon me.
We're twins. What an honor. Probably just three suggestions as you're thinking about your strategy. The western states, certainly, because they have such big federal land tracts. But I would encourage you to look at the coastal states as well. The Gulf Coast, the Pacific Coast, and the East Coast, they have their similar issues. And because we have as much coastline as they do, plus, we have to talk coastal issues, because we're talking a foreign language to the western states on NIFS, National Fisheries Right. Service. I mean, it's a whole different language set. So we do have some similarities, but we also need to reach out to those coastal states who have been very successful in getting some of their OCS issues navigating through these the ESA and other issues. So I would only encourage that. And then secondly, if you're looking at the ESA specifically in the language set itself, I would encourage you to look at some of their language that they've allowed to be defined by regulation, because what they've done is they've broadened their scope significantly from the early days, and probably even have some court cases that give them even further steps out. But if we're going to talk to Congress about specific language, the science has to be better defined. It just has to be, because we are the recipients of highly speculative science, and I think we just need to get better at that. I don't want species to be wiped out. I'm not interested in that. But I'm also not interested in us being wiped off the face economically. And we have to make a case for our economics as well as our ability to manage these things. And Alaska stands probably in the unique place in the world for the marine mammal protection. And we have done well at managing our fisheries. You have good science in many cases on your side, better than they have, I think. Now, we depend upon them, but that science needs to be better defined, I think.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator. Good suggestions.
And I'll just follow up on that. You know, you are the department commissioner that has the biologists, right? So I wouldn't look to law to be doing the science. I'd be looking to ADF&G. Right?
Yes.
So earlier, Senator Stoltz asked a question about climate change. You know, that's never really been tested related to the polar bear. There were theories put out about CO2 causing global warming, therefore we lose ice. And yet, when we go back and look at the populations of polar bears in our jurisdiction, there's been no change in the numbers. So do we have substantial science that underscores that? That I kind of look to your department for. You have the biologists. So I like Senator Coghill. That's great, these ideas of partnerships. But really, at the end of the day, there's that hard work of just doing the science and then getting to the table. And the way you get to the table is you join in a lawsuit. That's how the NGOs get to the table, and and engage the federal agencies. So there isn't really a question there, but so much as urging you to continue to get the science, to develop a robust science. So I'll let you continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Research, speaking of research.
Wow.
It's a small world, Senator, Madam Chair. It's a state strategy to conduct research and develop conservation actions that sometimes are less expensive and easier to develop than ESA requirements. So that is a focus. And then, in fact, that's the primary goal of our state wildlife action plan and wildlife diversity program. Now, a lot of this money comes from the federal sources with a Section 6 of the ESA. There's a 25% state match. You know, future funding levels are uncertain, I think, at federal and state levels. So that is a constraint that we have to address, and that may require more prioritization, more strategic thinking. But, I'm a big science guy. I believe in science as the basis for these decisions. So you can rest assured that's something that's high priority to me as Commissioner Cotton's representative. So it will be something we focus on or continue to focus on.
So, Mr. Rogers, a quick question then on science. So I was part of the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, mm-hmm. and one of the things we recognized was the robust work being done at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in Arctic issues. Do you collaborate or operate in a silo? I mean, this is another department, right, in state government, Department of Education, University of Alaska. What's the level of collaboration there?
Madam Chair, there is some existing today, and I can't give you the specifics. Moira might be able to tell you. But I have also begun conversations with Chancellor Rogers and others to talk about the possibility of additional collaboration with the university. And so that's going to be an ongoing discussion, but I've begun the process of trying to figure out how we can work together in the future. So
great.
It's a priority of mine.
And again, in the past, most recent past, some of those barriers were working on being broken down so that departments were cross-pollinating, so to speak.
Yes, ma'am. In fact, Madam Chair, I know about the silo issue. In my prior life at the Department of Environmental Conservation, I discovered that there were multiple agencies doing research on their own, no coordination, bumping into each other. We actually created a process called AQUA, which got everybody around the table, and they prioritized research needs and figured out who was going to do what. It's not a perfect solution, and I haven't checked in for a while on that. But silos create all kinds of inefficiencies, and I don't like silos. And I like to collaborate and communicate. That's one of the things I do. So I'll be working hard on that one.
Very good. Thank you. I'll let you continue.
Okay, so we talked about research. There's examples. I don't need to go through them, but there are examples of relevant research that we have done.
So again, let's pause here for a moment. The Alexander Archipelago Wolf. Is there actually such a subspecies?
I think there's a debate on that question, so I don't know how to answer that. Some people will call them southeast wolves, and populations vary within the southeast region, so I think I don't know what the I don't think anybody's settled on the exact term for that one.
Commissioner,
thank you, Madam Chair. It's been explained to me that if a petitioner is in hopes of success on getting something listed, they're better off taking a small chunk. Like, so some people will suggest that Prince of Wales Island is a distinct subspecies of gray wolves, and so that would make it easier perhaps to get a listing under those circumstances. So there's unfortunately Kim Titus, our chief wildlife scientist, isn't here. He's quite an expert on wolves, but his suggestion is that it is a southeast wolf, and even if you called it Alexander Archipelago Wolf, that's still a broad description. If you get down to just the Prince of Wales Island, then that's where it's got some problems. And our scientists don't think that there's a distinct subspecies. Our scientists think it's one population.
Okay.
So to follow up on that, I assume you're doing, you're developing a substantial scientific basis for that assertion.
Yes. And we've actually had conversations with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on this subject, and they haven't really concluded otherwise. At least they haven't announced a conclusion otherwise yet.
Good. Great. Senator Stoltz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think on that wolf issue in the Southeast, I think President Obama's former chief of staff and a Senate chief of staff, and I think his Alaska director probably all think there is, so we might be screwed on this one.
What would the implications be should these be listed as
not viable?
Species?
I wouldn't say that word.
What would the implications be, Commissioner, if this wolf were thought to be a distinct subspecies?
Well, I'm sure if it could, then it would go through the process that Mr. Rogers described earlier. There'd be a petition, or maybe already is a petition, but under the Section 7 consultation, they would end up with a biological opinion, and then if there's a federal, for example, if there are old-growth timber on federal land on Prince of Wales Island, then there would be perhaps restrictions on that, removing. So that'd be a concrete example of something that might be affected by it. I'm not sure if that's what you're looking for.
That is part of what I was looking for, and of course then the implication of how much further could this be expanded. So this is a subspecies, so now are gray wolves in general in Alaska threatened? Again, implicating our wildlife control, our intensive management of our wildlife. It just seems like a slippery slope.
Yeah, it's my understanding that there's no suggestion that gray wolves are endangered or threatened in general in Alaska. That's why I think that there may be some specific interest in trying to pinpoint it there and hoping to improve chances of success. But I don't want to arraign anybody's motives, but as Mr. Machicki had suggested earlier, sometimes there are agendas.
Yes. All right. Thanks.
Just to add, Madam Chair, that in terms of the real-world consequences of a listing, it is the consultation process that often leads to mitigation. I don't know if it very often leads to a denial of a permit. I think it often leads to mitigation measures and delays and lots of back and forth. Anything else on research? Or we're getting there, Madam Chair. So another strategy is to fully participate, and we've kind of said that before in various ways, but that's, data and information, comments, recovery planning. We've been deeply involved in polar bear recovery planning, which is coming, as I understand it, to a close here one of these days, and submitting Easter delisting petitions, for the Eastern DPS Stellar Sea Lion and the North Pacific DPS Humpback Whale. So, and the other thing we are doing, and I think the previous administration did it as well, is the meeting, at high levels to discuss some of the policy implications to help them understand, where we're coming from help us understand where they're coming from and possibly reach some kind of conclusion. We'll see. But that's ongoing. We've started that process. We're going to continue that process. And that applies not only to ESA, but ANILCA issues, for example, the new regulations in the park.
Excuse me, Mr. Rogers. So just for the public who's listening, DPS stands for Distinct
Population Segment. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I did say it earlier, but I need to remember to say it over and over. I'm as frustrated with the acronyms as you are, and I'd have to learn a whole new suite. Illegal, and Brad's really talked about this, and the standard that we're using, the Department of Law is using, and we are supporting, is that they have to be, if they're scientifically or legally deficient and unwarranted, we're going to look pretty hard at a challenge. If the science doesn't support it, if the legals, they didn't do it right, we're gonna take a hard look. And we also intervene in court cases where the state has an interest. Madam Chair, if Brad wants to chime in, I assume that's acceptable.
Mr. Mayan, did you want to comment on that slide?
Brad Mayan, through Madam Chair, only to the extent that if the federal agencies, whether it's the National Marine Fisheries Service or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, if they make a decision and then their decision is challenged by other groups or interests, but the state is supportive that they have actually gone through the right process and made the right conclusions, that you know, we would entertain intervening and supporting the federal agencies on that behalf. And we have done that on several occasions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, current litigation, and again, I'll ask Brad to supplement since he's managing these cases. The polar bear, the critical habitat designation was struck down and remanded to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And again, it was a 187 square mile proposal, 8% were state lands. There's been an appeal by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's underway. And then the bearded seal litigation, it was a threatened listing. It was struck down and remanded. And NMFS, National Marine Fisheries Service, has appealed that one. Let's focus on the bearded seal listing, which is a great example of some of the concerns that we've discussed and that I think you have. We've had a successful challenge in the district court. There's a lack of information and data connecting the dots between projected loss of sea ice and habitat needs. Very large current population, 155,000 animals approximately, so pretty healthy. No indication of current decline. And that was remanded to NMFS for additional work, and it's also under appeal.
Very good. So pause there for just a moment.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, I'm glad that you were in the department was engaged in that. So was the Resource Development Council, in other words, a private organization as well, worked pretty darn hard on that. A lot of us comment on these things as well. So while we may do our part as citizens and legislators, we will be looking to the department to be that the big gun, right? We'll be behind you all the way, but we need you to kind of be out there too. So just again a comment, urging robust action. I'll let you continue.
Understood, Madam Chair. Just a comment, the quote from Judge Beislein, which sort of sums it up, why he did what he did. And I give you, don't mind me reading, I think
please,
it's
that
probably
would be
worth the read. An unknown, unquantifiable population reduction, which is not expected to occur until nearly 100 years in the future, is too remote and speculative to support a listing as threatened. If the court were to hold otherwise, such a holding could logically render every species in the Arctic and subarctic areas potentially threatened. So that sort of sums it up. And incidentally, we are currently, and I think Commissioner Cotton mentioned this, we're currently considering similar litigation on that ring seal listing. That's under discussion as we speak. And I would thank you.
Senator Stoltz had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The North Slope Borough has a pretty noted research department for game and fish. Do you work with them on routinely? I guess not routinely. You haven't been here long enough to create a routine, but is that an expectation that will be a partnership?
We haven't yet, but we're certainly looking for partners for a lot of other reasons on research. As Mr. Rogers mentioned, the University of Alaska has reached out to us, and so we're anxious to work with them. The North Slope Borough would be another logical partner. So I know they've already filed a suit on the ring seal, as has AOGA. So we understand that they've got some science capabilities there that it would make sense to work with them on.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, I guess I have a cautionary with the University of Alaska. I would have been a little bit worried if you were partnering with Mr. Steiner on litigation and having him assist you and other folks. It is a stereotype, but it's one borne out by a lot of real examples of university faculty not having being in the mainstream of Alaskan thought and opinion.
Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Senator Stoltz. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Do you find that the industry is very active in following these cases and litigating the Resource Development Council, the AOGA, other organizations?
Commissioner, yes.
Senator, was the question, have they been active?
Yeah, do you find that they've been very active in litigating these matters?
Madam Chair, I believe that AOGA has filed suit already with on the ring seal issue, so that's an example of action. I know that that's been a concern that if there's a recovery plan or mitigation measures being employed, it could easily have an effect on industry operations. And so I've noticed that they're very active, but we haven't worked directly with them.
The only reason I ask is with declining budgets, obviously you're probably going to have a hard time in the future having as a robust litigation and robust research and analysis as we've had. And if industry is picking that up, that's a good thing.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Senator Coghill.
One of the things that we become increasingly aware of is not only the economics, but the National Environmental Policy Act, for example, has given us reason to do a lot of science in Alaska. Some of that has brought significant benefit to our fisheries. So some of these suits that are taken are almost defensive in order for them to be able to finish the science and the public comment on the National Environmental Policy Act. I know that many times it's proprietary, but there are many things that we should be able to benefit from, and I would encourage us to think that through, even with regard to the environment and the ESA and the Endangered Species Act. So they all flow together in many, many places in Alaska.
Very good. One last question, gillnets on the Kenai and Kasiilof. Are you commenting on that or appealing that?
Madam Chairman, the opportunity to file for a request for reconsideration is still open. We are, it's not just some little note you can send in. It's quite an extensive document, so we're actually, I'm not sure whether I should make an announcement or whatever. We're working on that internally, and we will be prepared to submit that should we feel that's necessary. We'd had some hopes that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would actually overturn that based on incompatibility, but we're not confident that they will do that. We will be prepared to file a notice of reconsideration should that be the best course of action.
And, Madam Chair, I'll make sure you know about that.
Thank you. Senator Stoltz, a question.
I would just offer, this is one of those areas where there's a concomitance of opinion between sport and commercial, and this ought to be a great kumbaya moment for the department to help everybody out.
Waiting for this moment, yes.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your presentation. We have reached the end point of our committee meeting, and I appreciate you coming. I know we've asked some pretty hard questions. You can see this is a committee that has intense interest in this subject matter. So I appreciate you being here. So this will conclude our meeting for today. Let the record reflect that it is 5 p.m., and the meeting is adjourned.